I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kansas City was one of the only major U.S. cities without a street named after Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. until January this year. That's when the city council voted to change the name of Paseo Boulevard. Today, pushback on that decision means that voters will choose which name is to be on street signs. We'll hear from an original supporter to honor Dr. King and one who views the switch as disenfranchisement of residents along the boulevard. Then we have seen the uglier side of social media as platforms meant for civil discourse have become home to hate speech. We'll examine who spreads online propaganda, how they became so prominent, and how you can recognize them in your social media. We'll get you up to date after the news. In January, the Kansas City Council voted 8-4 to rename the Paseo after the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. But that wasn't the end of the story. Frustrated by what they're calling the disenfranchisement of residents along the street, a group called Save the Paseo gathered signatures to restore the name the Paseo to the well-known boulevard. The group forced a vote that will now take place on November 5th to decide the issue, maybe once and for all. Now a conversation with representatives from both sides of this disagreement. With us, Andre Logan is a member of the Save the Paseo Committee and part of the group's communications team. Andre, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you, Steve.
The Reverend Vernon Howard is also here. He's a senior pastor at St. Mark Union Church and president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference of Greater Kansas City. He's been an advocate of the name change. Reverend Howard, nice to have you again. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be here.
Well, Andre, what's your objection here to the naming of the street after Dr. King?
Well, it's not necessarily an objection to a street being named after Dr. King.
Nothing to do with King himself.
No, not at all. Not at all. You know, what this is about, it's about love and process. You know, our committee is, we're here to honor Dr. Martin Luther King, but our committee is also, has a love for the Paseo itself. There was issue that was taken with the process that was undertaken by the group, the SCLC, as well as the city council.
In what way? What happened?
Well, basically, originally from the timeline that has been put out there is the SCLC and the pastors, they decided that they wanted to have the Paseo changed to Dr. Martin Luther King. From that, there were marches, there were an initial petition to try and put it to a vote. From that, you know, there was not a lot of traction. Then the mayor got involved and put together an advisory council to put forward three different ideas.
This is Mayor James.
Mayor
now.
James, yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. And then after that, in January, there was a vote that was put to the city that the city council took to change the name. Part of that process, of course, there was no.
It was jammed down the throats of residents, or what are you suggesting here? Just
well,
so I'm trying to cut through it.
So basically, yes, it was. There was no input from the residents that live along the Paseo itself. So, with that, you know, what we wanted was a voice in the process. There were advisory committees that were out there that were getting suggestions about what should be done in order to honor Dr. Martin Luther King.
Right.
But for those people that actually live on the street, there was no input from them, you know.
If a process had been followed, would you have been okay with changing the name?
Yes. If we had more of a voice in that process, if we had more of a say as to, you know, if this is the right thing to do, if we had a chance to actually say, we want Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, the Paseo to be changed to Dr. Martin Luther King. I think many of the people that are on the committee, many of the constituents that we've talked to as we've gone out and knocked on door to door, that's one of the things that they're most upset about is that they weren't asked about the change.
Let me ask Dr. Howard here about this. So folks feel left out of the process. Reverend Howard, what about that?
We have 100 signatures from MLK Boulevard residents who have signed on to this initiative. More than 200 grassroots organizations that have signed on to it. including major leaders here in the community, such as U.S. Congressman Emanuel Cleaver.
But is it still possible that the residents themselves weren't asked enough about how they feel about this change?
If a resident feels that way, they have every right to that opinion. Certainly, we have rights to our opinions. The 100 signatures of residents, though, I think is key. We did canvassing and door knocking on the households of residents on MLK Boulevard.
And when you did that, how much support were you receiving as opposed to people saying, no, I won't sign your petition?
Well, we've got 100 signatures of those along MLK Boulevard. We didn't necessarily record persons who were, for example, in favor or against or mm-hmm. who were on the fence on it. So we feel like that the outreach has been sufficient and effective. And so the process with respect to outreach, I think it's pretty clear. We have the citywide commission-sponsored events that took place. We have requirements to knock on doors and to pass out literature. So mm-hmm. we did that. I think, Steve, the issue becomes if one has a problem with the process, then we believe that from a standpoint of outreach that we did and from the standpoint of what the city council did are very much legal and sound with respect to these kinds of issues.
Andre, what about this? Reverend Howard just said they had 100 signatures from residents along the Paseo itself. What about that?
Well, there's about 1,800 residents that live on the Paseo. We have, with our petition that we submitted, about between 100 to 200 people that live on the Paseo that signed that petition. We turned in over 2,000 signatures to get it put on the ballot.
So you're saying there's at least that many residents living along the Paseo, at least 100 who oppose it as well?
Correct.
If not more, right. Yeah. Okay.
You know, and I think if you look at the Paseo, I mean, depending on, I don't know where they got their signatures from. Of course, we did a large swath, you know, from the beginning of the Paseo all the way to the very end, to the south side of Paseo. And we got signatures all along the way. Obviously, the 2,800 signatures that we got to put it on the ballot, you know, that's a victory for us because mm-hmm. now those people that live on the street, now they have a chance to voice their opinion about whether or not this is the right thing for the Paseo to be changed or to be changed to Martin Luther King or to be changed back to the Paseo.
Although this will be a citywide vote now.
It will be a citywide vote,
yeah.
Correct.
Is it 1,800 residents who live along the Paseo or 1,800 homes? I just want to be clear here.
I don't know the answer to that, I believe.
Reverend Howard, you know, at this point, if the vote were to recommend that the name be switched back to the Paseo, I'm wondering what kind of message would that send to the rest of the country if Dr. King's name was then removed from the street?
Well, we believe this represents a major setback if it were to happen within racial justice, racial diversity, and racial inclusion in Kansas City. We believe that being the first major metropolitan city to strip away from its streets or boulevards the name of Dr. King.
Although other cities have done it. I'm not sure if they're major cities or not, has happened.
They are not major, and they have been in areas governmentally, politically, that are high tension areas with respect to racial justice and racial integration. So if it were to happen, it would signal that we are in that kind of group, in that kind of sector, particularly those in the Deep South who had made these kinds of decisions. And so we believe it'll be a setback in racial justice and racial inclusion in this country. We are also hearing from both those in the majority and minority communities with respect to civic and business and corporate leaders. Folks are saying they may not want to come to Kansas City for tourism, may not want to come to Kansas City for conventions.
If the name is changed.
If the name is changed, and they would avoid this city because of that. So much is at stake, I think, from a racial justice, racial diversity issue, but also from an economic issue.
Andre, what about that? If you were to change the name at this point, actually the visual of removing Dr. King's name from the street, the the boulevard.
Right.
What kind of message would that send?
I think it sends a message that, you know, the people that live in this city matter. I think it's a matter of, you know, Dr. King fought for the civil rights for everyone, right? And this is a civil rights issue for the people that live along that boulevard. This isn't about, you know, I'm not going to play into the fear of, you know, other people might not come to this city, or the fear that, you know, this is a setback for us. You know, this is for our group. We've always been about trying to find the proper way to honor Dr. Martin Luther King, which is part of the reason why the task force was put together in the first place, to look at different alternatives. You know, we wanted to build a consensus about what's the right way to honor Dr. Martin Luther King. This isn't about if the street is the right thing, or if it's the terminal, or if it's another street. You know, we could name another street.
You had the sense when the community was going through that conversation at large that people really couldn't settle on one idea. There was people we did shows on. People were all over the place.
Sure,
on that issue,
sure. They certainly were, you know, and there's even more ideas. But that's where it's important to have community involvement with this particular issue, because this is a great Dr. Martin Luther King was one of the greatest Americans that ever lived, you know, and so we've had other homages to him within the city, whether it was schools that were named after Dr. Martin Luther King, or the park that was renamed in 1978 for Dr. Martin Luther King.
Right.
I mean, it's not like we haven't had ways to honor him, but this is such a big issue, and it becomes a divisive issue because, you know, people love the Paseo. They work on the Paseo. You know, there's high schools. There's a historical value that's there that we shouldn't erase.
Let me get our listeners involved here. We're curious of what they think about this street name controversy. Should Dr. King's name remain, or do you like the idea of changing the name back to the Paseo? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Reverend Howard, there was a whole lot of talk about how Dr. King should be commemorated in our city. We were the only major city in the country without a street named after him. Why did you pick the Paseo? Why not 63rd Street? There was conversations about that. How did we wind up on the Paseo?
We wound up on the Paseo because the community asked us to initiate this action to do such. This was not SCLC's idea, was not any of the idea of the civil rights groups. It actually emanated from a pastor who served for decades at the Paseo Baptist Church, the Reverend Dr. Charles Briscoe, who approached SCLC along with the Baptist Ministers Union and along with other grassroots organizers and pastors such as Bishop Mark C. Tolbert, and said, your organization is the best to lead us in this because you have advocated for the dream of Dr. King for so long. So this request came to us, and we feel like it was legitimate in terms of his grassroots and a community-based kind of desire. I do want to correct something, though. We do believe that in the instance of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, it is actually a superior choice to 63rd Street and Truce. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard is actually a racially integrated corridor. Some 20% or so persons who live along the corridor are actually non-African-American. Hmm. And so it meets at least that threshold when compared to Troost or compared to 63rd Street. The other thing is that because it is a boulevard, it will receive the benefit of ongoing maintenance and beautification dollars that will allow it to continue to be the beautiful corridor that it is. Mm-hmm. I would say, thirdly, if there was this kind of desire, sincere, genuine desire to honor Dr. King, then why had there not been some kind of comprehensive effort over the course of the last 4 or 5 years, like neighborhoods and grassroots people have done for the Paseo? Why wasn't that done for Truce? Why wasn't that done for 63rd? The opposition is asking us to take this away and has, to my knowledge and our knowledge, no comprehensive plan or initiative to provide an alternative to the Paseo. It is take it down and then let's see what will happen. We have grassroots organizations that have been working on this for 4 years or so and have had success with the support of the city. If they're concerned so much, where have they been? Where were they?
Andre, a little history here. How did we arrive at the name the Paseo? Where did that name come from? Just give us the one paragraph primer here.
So the Paseo was, started George Kessler, part of the Parks Department. They decided to obviously beautify our city with these major boulevards, and the Paseo was one of the first boulevards that was ever instituted in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. Paseo de la Reforma was the original name, and it's from a Spanish city that means a beautiful plaza, basically. Mm-hmm. And that's the origination of it.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Matthew from Kansas City, Missouri. He's at 58th and the Paseo. Matthew, good morning.
Hey there, Steve. How you doing?
Well, thank you.
I just wanted to comment and say, I know we were talking about the underrepresentation earlier here on the program, and definitely on my block with my neighborhood, that was a real big one. I felt like when the original change happened in January, a lot of me and my fellow neighbors, especially here on the south side of Kansas City, didn't really feel like we had any representation on the choice of whether that we wanted to keep the name of the Paseo or change it to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. And kind of what was being said earlier was the fact that maybe if we had more representation originally, that we would be better okay with the decision to change it. But like it's been said, I feel like a lot of the community, especially in the South Side, has felt disenfranchised with this choice.
Right.
And it's kind of giving us the opportunity to finally say what we feel and how we want to represent ourselves here on the Paseo.
All right, Matthew, thank you for your comments. Let's go to Justin from Kansas City, Missouri. Justin, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about whether the name of the Paseo should remain Martin Luther King Boulevard or revert back to the Paseo. Good morning.
Sure. I was just curious why it had never been raised to change the J.C. Nichols to Dr. Martin Luther King, considering the racist housing policies of Mr. Nichols.
Where do we stand about that? Once upon a time when I was a columnist, I suggested as much in the Kansas City Star, Dr. Howard. Where is that whole thing?
I'm not aware of any organized effort with respect to J.C. Nichols. I do think, though, that what he brings up is the notion of race. And when we look at the Save the Paseo petition initiative, there are approximately 100 or so signatures on that petition that are from the major zip code that is predominantly African-American. That's a 64130. That zip code has some 24,000 African-Americans. There are approximately 100 signatures from that particular zip code. If you go to the number 2 zip code, which is 64128, approximately 14,000 to 15,000 African-Americans. There are 20 signatures from that particular zip code alone of the 2,700 that they mentioned. This issue is also about race, as this gentleman mentioned, in terms of the historical journey or trek, if you will, of race relations in Kansas City. Let me finish this. When we talk about this initiative and this issue, we are talking about a predominantly white-led initiative.
Is that true,
Andre?
That's not true at all.
You want to respond?
That's not true at all. I mean, this is a grassroots organization. When we first got together back in March, this is people from all backgrounds. You know, we have white, we have black, we have Hispanic, we have gay, lesbian. We cover the entire swath and spectrum of the people that live in this city. It's not a monolith in terms of this is a white-led organization by any means or any stretch of the imagination.
You know, so when we do the, Steve, when we do the research on where the signatures come from, it bears out a different fact, and that is that there are far less signatures from predominantly black zip codes in this city. And this does speak to the issue of race relations, of white dominance, and how a majority white group can lead an issue to affect a change of something in a predominantly black area.
Andre,
that's a race issue and has to do with white privilege and has to do with systemic and structural racism in this city. And unless Kansas City catches up to this whole notion of being awoke to systemic and structural issues of racism, we're going to continue to lag behind.
Well, that racism that you speak of and that disenfranchisement is what your group has done to our
to the people that live on that particular street. I mean, like I said, this is, yes, you may cherry pick, you know, different names or segments that sign the petition, but, you know, the fact of the matter is that we have over 2,000 signatures of people that want the street or at least put to a vote for them to have a voice.
And most of those signatures are white.
Regardless if it's white, regardless if it's black, regardless if it's Hispanic, I don't know how you can tell the color of somebody by their signature.
Because we have racial data that is based on
zip codes. Yeah, but I guarantee you, you did not go through all 2,700 of our signatures and figure out if they're white or black.
You can't do that, but you can't do that. But you can figure where a zip code is and what the predominant race of those zip codes are. We do have that.
So to be clear, Reverend, have you gone through name by name to figure out whether the signers are black or white, or are you just basing this on?
You cannot do that on a petition initiative. You can do it by zip code.
Yeah, but can't you do research and figure out?
You absolutely can. And that's what we have done. And we have come to that determination.
So you've ascertained whether the signers are black or white as you've gone through. Those are the numbers you're throwing out here.
Well, you would need much more detail than that. What you can do is you can go through and look at how many come from a particular zip code. For example, there are in 64128 some 14,000 African Americans. In that zip code, there are 20 signatures. Okay. Now, all of them may not even be African-American, but you get a sense of where the makeup is. If a group that was predominantly African-American were to go to a predominantly white area such as Warno Road and Ward Parkway and say, we have an interest now in changing the name of that,
right,
that would be unheard of. And there are those who in Kansas City would say, this is not right. This is not a good thing, because it is that community's determination.
Let me go to another phone call here. Kathy from Peculiar, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. I know I'm not a Kansas City resident, but I have worked in Kansas City for decades, and I have lived there. I mean, lived around the area. I've worked there, played there, go there to eat, go there for recreation, okay, take my visitors there. When this first came up, I wondered if it was considered, I'm assuming the tax force did, consider honorary naming of a street like they do in Chicago. When I visited there, I noticed they had two street names sometimes. One would be an honorary for a person. And I'm wondering if that's something they would think of re-looking at if...
Gotcha, Kathy. Let me grab a response here from Andre. An honorary name as opposed to an actual name change, I think, is what she's driving at.
Well, again, from our committee, we're not necessarily opposed to having a street named for Dr. Martin Luther King.
Right.
You know, if it's honorary or if it's the actual name, you know, that's up to, again, it should be up to the people to decide whether or not that's what they want. It's not necessarily a small group of people that are pushing this through, you know, without the voice of the people that live along that particular street, whether it's 63rd Street, whether it's J.C. Nichols, whether it's Ward Parkway. Dr. Martin Luther King fought for everyone. It shouldn't be just a predominantly black situation or street or that goes into a black area. It should cross all colors. That's what he wanted.
We're going to leave our conversation right there because we're out of time. The vote on the name change will be on November 5th here in Kansas City. I want to thank Andre Logan. He's with the Save the Paseo Committee. The Reverend Vernon Howard, president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference of Greater Kansas City. Thank you both for good conversation. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the folks who are hijacking the Internet and how that's changing America. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back, and I wish it was 67 degrees. I'm Steve Kraske. If you're not subscribed to my weekly newsletter, Kraske Off Mic, I've got a question for you. Why not? It's never too late. Go to kcur.org/Kraske to sign up. There's exclusive insights from me and highlights from the up-to-date team. Again, just go to kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, two Republican senators join me to discuss gun violence in Missouri and if there are any legislative steps available to address the issue. Join us tomorrow for that important conversation. Well, the idea seems simple. If you can make an idea go viral, then you can tip elections, overthrow dictators, start movements, and revolutionize industries. That's the thinking of one of the fringe figures that Andrew Morantz writes about in his new book, Anti-Social, Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. As the title suggests, the book is a deep look into how certain gatecrashers or conspiracists and white supremacists spread their fringe ideas online and the epic consequences for what they're capable of doing. Also examined are the folks who created these platforms and are doing little when it comes to monitoring the tools they've built. Andrew Morantz is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and Anti-Social is his first book. Andrew, welcome. Nice to have you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me.
You know, once upon a time, Twitter and Facebook were going to bring people together and foster all this great debate in this country over the issues of the day. But instead, these platforms have been hijacked by hate. At least that's one of the main points of your book. Why do the hate mongers have such power and so much influence, Andrew?
These systems were designed, the word I use is techno-utopianism. They were designed as this kind of utopia where everything would just be unfiltered, everything would be liberated, and the marketplace of ideas was supposed to sort it all out for us, kind of automatically.
Mm-hmm.
And that was never really going to happen. And, you know, it was just a kind of blind leap of faith that a lot of these founders had. You know, actually, the quote that you read there at the top was from, just an entrepreneur, not a, you know, some member of the Klan or something like that, just a normal guy who was trying to make a buck by promoting memes on Facebook. And the memes were pretty apolitical at first. But, you know, this superpower, as he called it, can really be used for anything. You know, I would sit in people's living rooms because this is really a work of in-depth reporting and kind of longitudinal reporting. I didn't want it to just be my opinion, you know, sitting on my computer keyboard.
Right.
So I would sit with people and watch over their shoulder as they did this. And there was nothing stopping them. They could get a hashtag trending on Twitter. People would see it. Journalists would see it. It would then go into slide into the TV landscape. And from there, it would go into the national newspapers. And I just watched it happen again and again to the point where I would know which kind of media manipulators' fingerprints would be on which news narrative on a given day.
How much power do they have?
It's immense. I mean, all these things are completely tied together. What the president sees on his Twitter account, what we all see in the national news, it's all enmeshed because social media is designed to be flat and free of hierarchies. The notion of distinguishing between something that's true or false or something that is morally good or bad, that has all come to seem sort of old-fashioned and fusty and almost anti-democratic to care about those distinctions. The notion of social media is that you're all just supposed to throw everything into a pot and sort of see what comes out of it. And the hope of these guys, you know, Zuckerberg and Dorsey and the Reddit founders who I spent a lot of time with for the book, they just sort of had this blind hope that it would all work out for the best. And I don't think there was any evidence for that ever. And now it's kind of too late. They're starting to see it. You know, I actually was embedded at the Reddit offices right after the march in Charlottesville. And the guys who founded that company actually went to the University mm-hmm. of Virginia. So they were very personally disturbed to see their platform being used
wow.
to organize hate in that way. And so then, you know, it was kind of too little too late, a lot of people felt. But they sort of said, okay, we are going to go scrub all this stuff off our platform. And they let me sit in the room and watch as a bunch of Reddit employees opened up their laptops and started deleting subreddits that had swastikas on them or that were otherwise violent. And it felt weird because it was a bunch of, you know, people in their 20s, people in their 30s wearing hoodies and, you know, literally eating string cheese and, you know, drinking bottles of seltzer and stuff. And yet, if they weren't going to control this, nobody was.
Hmm.
So it's disturbing to us to think that there are people behind the curtain, but it's even more disturbing to think that there might not be.
You know, as a society, are we getting any smarter about all this? Are we onto the way they manipulate us? What's your sense?
I think some people are, but the danger is that, you know, to want to throw up your hands and say, well, I'll never know what's true. I'll never know what's misinformation. Maybe I should just, you know, stop trying to even be informed. And that's a danger, too. So it's definitely good to be aware and be skeptical. But I wanted to really look at this stuff so specifically, you know, not because I wanted to spend 3 years on the road hanging out with trolls and disinformation agents and, you know, Silicon Valley big shots rather than my own family, but because I felt that if you weren't right there in the room with these people, if you weren't seeing how they experience the world and seeing what they look like when their mask slips off, then you wouldn't really get it. You know, I even went into the White House briefing room with a guy who was essentially just a performance artist, you know, just a troll who wanted to shake things up and freak out the kind of cultural elites. And so he basically just pretended to be a real reporter and went in there and kind of made this performative mockery of the process that happens there. Now, you know, that can be fun sometimes to just sort of mock, you know, traditional elite institutions. There's a lot wrong with those institutions. But if all we're going to do is tear stuff down and we don't have any vision of how to build it back up, then I think we're in trouble.
Andrew Morantz is my guest. His new book, Antisocial Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. Can you give me a public radio friendly version of the types of things these people advocate? What kinds of things are we talking about here?
Some of it is just Nazis. I mean, some of it is, you know, the oldest and most disgusting and discredited ideas out there. And some of it, I was shocked at how unoriginal it was, especially, you know, I'm Jewish and I didn't expect to go into this as a Jewish reporter, having that be an issue. You know, I thought that kind of stuff was behind us, frankly. And I was really surprised that a lot of these people who are professional anti-Semites, A, were so hung up on that, and B, couldn't tell that I was Jewish. I was like, you know, you could have just Googled my name. They weren't very sophisticated about it. But then there are other things that are more subtle. You know, there's some misogyny. There's some just spinning and misinformation. You know, you see it now with the impeachment stuff. You see a lot of these people getting really busy trying to spin, you know, sort of not outright lies sometimes, but just very, very carefully chosen facts to make it look like the president did nothing wrong. You can also see it in what I call, you know, there's this concept of the Overton window. And the Overton window is a concept of what is permissible to say, what is, in polite society, acceptable. And, you know, we think about how it shifts in positive directions often, you know, the ending of de jure segregation, the ending of, you know, lots of things in our history that have moved in the right direction. But it can move in the wrong direction, too. And sometimes it can be subtle. Sometimes it can be very overt. So, and a lot of it also is just people trying to cloud the informational ecosystem so that people don't know what they're seeing. They can't trust anything.
Right.
You know, and a lot of this is the kind of thing that we worry about Russian trolls doing or Iranian disinformation campaigns doing. But the people I was with, they weren't anonymous. They weren't secret. They weren't state agents. They were just, you know, mostly people sitting in their living rooms trying to make a buck or trying to make a point. And they let me sit with them for as long as I wanted because they weren't breaking the law. They weren't even breaking the rules of Twitter in most cases.
You know, who's susceptible to this stuff that these gatecrashers, as you call them, put out? Has there been research done on who might be vulnerable to getting sucked in here?
Yeah, there are. Nothing is 100% correlation.
Right.
But there are some signs, you know, if you have a teenage kid, let's say, who is maybe really high IQ but low EQ, and they find it really fun
EQ
to kind of
being
emotional intelligence.
Okay.
Yeah,
sure.
Emotional quotient. So if you know, if you find that you have someone in your life who they have a really tough time connecting with people in the real world, but they're very interested in delving super deep into questioning everything they read, obviously, this should go without saying, it's great to question what you read. It's great to be skeptical. But people can really, really take it too far and be so skeptical of everything that they just, you know, like a teacher of mine once said, they're so open-minded that their brain falls out. Mm. They just start going down these rabbit holes. And, you know, sometimes it might just be some weird bit of fiscal policy or something. But other times, as I said, it could be the worst, most discredited ideas in modern history. And, you know, you never really know, especially if you're a parent to a child or, you know, a sibling or something, they might start throwing around sort of opaque phrases and terms that you've never heard before because they're frankly entering an informational world that normies, as they call them, don't inhabit. And so at that point, I think the best move is to, you know, not freak out and not get angry, but to just sort of say, well, can you explain that to me? And can you ground that in some history and some facts? These things have an informational landscape all to their own. They're not just isolated hate slogans. They're in fact, this entire world, this entire mental vocabulary that as you listen to these podcasts and as you read these blogs, they sort of replace your old mental vocabulary.
Right.
So it's almost like a cult conditioning process sometimes.
You know, as you're talking here, I'm wondering, has the mainstream media's traditional gatekeeper function all but evaporated? Because it used to be that the mainstream media sort of kept all this stuff at bay. Is it all irrelevant now somehow?
Yeah, I think it has largely evaporated. Not entirely, but largely. And, you know, obviously there are many upsides to that. You know, there was always a problem with the traditional media being corporate controlled in many cases, being too monolithic, being too white, too male, too intolerant of marginal voices in many cases. So it's great to open that landscape up. The problem, though, is that when the Silicon Valley people started to do this, they thought about disruption, they thought about innovation, they thought about moving fast and breaking things. And, you know, it just seemed self-evident to them that they should take as much power away from gatekeepers as they could. The problem is that they then became the new gatekeepers, and they just didn't admit it, even to themselves. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to think of themselves as gatekeepers. They only wanted to think of themselves as liberators. And the problem is that if you have this power and this responsibility that you won't even admit to yourself and that you won't figure out how to act on, you're just going to bungle the job. And that's what they did. They took on all this power from the old gatekeeping institutions. They bled them dry. They starved them of their economic income. They took that power from them, and then they didn't do anything with that power except, you know, just hope and pray and cross their fingers that it would all work out. And so now they're trying to come to the table and say, okay, we actually do have this curatorial role. We do have this managerial role. But these systems were not designed to be properly fenced in and properly curated. They were designed to be slot machines for emotional engagement and anger and fear and rage and all the rest of it. So virality is built around emotional engagement, and that itself is the core of the problem. If these systems are designed to give you points and make you more addicted every time you feel some spike of emotion in your brainstem, it's very, very hard for them to reverse that whole incentive structure and then say, well, let's be thoughtful and let's be rational. It's not how the system is built.
Andrew Morantz is the author of the book Anti-Social Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. It's a great read. It's an important read. Andrew, thanks for taking some time. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, Brian and Spencer and some fun stuff to do this weekend. Well, look who's here. Brian McTavish and Spencer Hardwick talk about your weekend to-do list. Brian writes and talks about pop culture. Spencer is the founder and curator of Wire KC Weekender. Welcome.
Good to be here, as
everybody.
Always, Steve.
Yeah, welcome back. Spencer, tell me about Nelly.
Yes. So
that's who we're listening to
you
here.
You guys, I've on several occasions, you guys have recounted the artist of your lifetimes, middle school, high school. For me, one of those was Nelly.
Nelly.
So around the turn of the century, Nelly was all over middle schools and high schools everywhere. And so it's really cool to have him here in Kansas City at KC Live, Friday, 7 p.m. Did you know that Nelly is a top five rap-selling artist of all time?
I did not know that.
Did not know that. He's also from the Show Me State.
Is that right?
A lot of his music is about St. Louis, but every once in a while he will give a shout-out to KC, so I'm sure that his fans, and it should be a sellout crowd, are going to give him a lot of props for that.
Where's he going to be?
He's going to be KC Live Friday at 7 p.m. Should be a great time.
So Nelly, a big one, at least in your life, and you're going to be in the front row,
Now, you guys have a favorite Nelly song, right?
How did you know?
Yeah, I'm listening to it right now. You picked my favorite.
All I can say is, whoa, Nelly.
No,
whoa,
there it is.
Well, there you go. Okay. What have you brought us here?
Well, I brought you
Matt and Kim,
a musical duo that is so happy that they're happy to scrape their knees on the concrete, as they say in that song, Come Together Now. That's actually from the Lego Movie 2.
Mm.
It's Matt and Kim. They're everywhere. They're
the eclectic electronic duo.
Yeah, say eclectic. I can't
eclectic
even say it.
Electronic duo.
I wrote that, but I can't say it. 7 o'clock
I've
Sunday.
Done that
before. Yeah, 7 o'clock Sunday at the Arvis Bank Theater at the Midland, from sprightly punk to pure pop and lots of interesting stuff in between. What we have is Matt Johnson and Kim Schifino, who began playing Brooklyn Lofts and the like in the early 2000s and have since built a ridiculously accessible alternative music career. It boils down to one thing: happiness, overarching happiness. They're
wow.
also a couple, which helps. Might not help some nights on stage, but they are so happy and so high energy in communicating their unambiguous joy in songs like Go Go, Daylight, Let's Go, Yeah Yeah, It's
My
All Right.
Goodness.
I could go on. The trend here: be yourself, do your own thing, and live life positively to the fullest. That's Matt and Kim. Check them out.
Okay.
Who let the dogs out?
Who did leave the dogs out?
Listen.
I always hear the question, never the answer.
This is also one of those turn of the century songs that had everybody rocking. Now, help me out here, Steve. It says D-O-G-A. Is that Doga or Dogga, you think?
You bringing the information in here, it's on
there,
you.
There you go. I think that's an open question. What's not an open question is that if you're
Doga.
A dog lover.
Doga.
We'll go with that. If you're a dog lover.
Danny Alexander,
lover,
our producer, just whispered in my ear.
There
Doga.
You go.
Huh.
Doga. Well, if you're a dog lover or a yoga lover, you
like
should
Dogga,
go down
but it's
to
Doga.
Doga. And this is yoga with dogs, so it's friend dog
yoga with
yoga.
Dogs.
Exactly, 45
Why not?
Minutes. Exactly, just throwing all these things that we love together. The cherry on top of this whole event is you can bring your dog and bring your yoga mat. I was gonna make a pun about
what
downward
do the dogs
dog.
Do?
Yeah, I think that's an open question. They won't be doing downward dog though.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
You know,
they don't have to worry about that, do they? Yeah.
The cherry on top here is that you get a free mimosa after class. So there's something for everybody. It's a Sunday, 10 a.m. It's gonna be bright out at Berkeley Riverfront Park. And here's the other thing.
It's a little
other
chilly
cities,
at Riverfront Park.
It can be. The other thing here is that I've actually seen goat yoga, and they put a small baby mountain goat on your back when you're stretching. You should Google it. I'm totally serious.
Okay, I think maybe I've heard of that too. But Doga Yoga coming up Sunday at 10 a.m. down on the riverfront, right?
Yep.
Don't shed your tears. Just dream your dreams of glory. All souls live on. Forever, there's no need to cry. Hear my heart beating like the wings of a thousand angels, strong together.
Gone. Who is what? What is what? What are we doing here?
The body dies. Alas.
What?
But the soul survives, some say. In any event, remembrance of us all can live on long after we're gone, maybe longer for some than others, which brings us to the 2019 Graveyard. That's right, Graveyard 5K Run and Walk. It's a fundraising event for Kansas City's second oldest cemetery, the Elmwood Cemetery at 4900 Truman Road.
Good time of year to go out there.
It's nice and crisp to walk among the deceased.
Yes.
9 to noon on Saturday, Elmwood Cemetery. Where to begin, or perhaps more appropriately, where to end it here?
Oof.
Woof indeed. By the way, the dog thing, dogs don't care how cold it is. They'll just have fun out there while freezing humans are playing yoga. Okay, so back to Graveyard Land, Elmwood Cemetery. Get there right at 9 o'clock on Saturday if you can. Lots of famous people buried there. I could go on about the 766 Civil War soldiers or the Armour family,
who
gave us Armour Boulevard. But real quick, Patricia Ellis, she made more than 40 Hollywood movies, mostly B-movies, but she did movies with James Cagney and Laurel and Hardy, and she's in the cemetery, so wave as you're strolling by when you go by her marker. This is a weird Halloween fun thing to do, and it helps keep up the headstones.
Okay.
Yeah.
A lot of early stuff going on this weekend.
Yeah.
Got to get out of bed this weekend. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
With each other. We gotta start making changes. Learn to see me as a brother instead of two.
back to the latest kid. That sounds pretty good.
That's the way it is.
What is it? Yeah.
This is Poetry Slam Against Violence by Set Shakur, which is Tupac's sister,
wow,
as well as Omar Gooding, who is Cuba Gooding Jr.'s sibling as well.
Oh, wow.
So, Steve, we know that music has the ability to move people, and rap, especially over the past 2, 3, 4 decades, has been really socially and commercially successful at doing just that. Mm-hmm. So these two are actually teaming up to put on a Poetry Slam, bringing in poets not only from across the country, but also from across Kansas City. So a nice national and local feel. There'll be R&B, there'll be spoken word artists, and even a little bit of jazz at this event as well.
No kidding. I wonder how they got together.
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that, but they probably will say a little bit about that at the opening. I just know that whenever I've been to a spoken word session or any type of show like this around the country, there's been a lot of energy, and it's a feeling that you don't forget.
Yeah.
And so I'm really excited to see what they have between the punchlines, the poetry, and the jazz. I love the injection of the Kansas City jazz. This should be a really special night. 6:45 p.m. on Saturday at PlexPod. That's the old Westport Middle School.
On East 39th Street.
That's
right.
The one.
Okay, and finally today,
fear of the dark. I have a phobia that someone's always there.
My goodness.
All right,
woo,
here we go.
Yeah, here we go.
Let's end it with a bang. Another yes. Halloween-y thing to do. It's called Exiled KC, in which rugged types, not us, well, maybe you, but not me, rugged types will hike 45 to 60 minutes at night in the forest without a flashlight while being assailed by roaming monsters and other assorted maniacs.
Goodness.
But no kidding, you need a signed release form to participate. If you're man or woman enough or crazy enough, go to Exiled KC. It's at Zip KC in Bonner Springs, 9 to midnight this Friday and Saturday.
And on my list, Stefan Harris, the great vibraphonist, will be at the Folly Theater Saturday night at 8 o'clock. He's always worth seeing.
Well, great.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like this at all, though.
Well, you could try to scare him off stage.
You could. That's Brian McTavish, Spencer Hardwick with your weekend to-do list. Gentlemen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate
you.
Find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, our film critics are back, thank goodness, with reviews of the latest indie documentary and foreign films playing locally, including at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.